Welcome to In Business, part of the podcast called Peter Day's World of Business. You can also subscribe to the sister programme Global Business, also presented by Peter Day, on air 52 weeks a year. Listen out for more details after the programme. This week, a potent force in global finance. Peter Day investigates the pros and cons of microlending.
The hectic and multicoloured confusion of the most crowded country on earth is evident all around me along the frenzied riverside in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. But this is also the nation internationally recognised for what appears to be a very significant breakthrough in banking, the development of the micro-lending movement, which has found out ways of extending loans and other finance services to people who are very, very poor. Millions of people here in Bangladesh are involved, and of course it's the idea that won a Nobel Peace Prize for one of the founders of the micro-lending movement, Professor Muhammad Yunus of Grameen Bank. But in recent months, some people have been asking big questions about micro-lending, even though it's said to have benefited so many millions of poor people in many parts of the world, not just here in Bangladesh. Big Western commercial investors have been pouring big money into micro-lending in poor countries. We know that the credit crunch recession was started by the bursting of the American subprime loans bubble, bankers rushing to lend money to enable poor Americans to buy homes. So is there now a danger that in a similar way, the micro-loan boom is another bubble getting ready to burst? I'm here in Bangladesh, one of the first places where micro-lending started, to find out more. An anthem of praise from a group of women who are also regular borrowers from their beloved Grameen Bank. Grameen was set up to make tiny loans to poor people in 1976 by the man who's still in charge, Professor Muhammad Yunus. He's the one who realised that even if poor people have no property to put up as collateral for their loans, their reputation among their neighbours is just as valuable. He's become the global public face of microcredit. And a few months ago, on a visit to London, he told me how he made it work.
Microcredit was more for the villagers, mostly women. These are illiterate women who takes a small amount of money, like $30, $35 worth of loan, and start an income-generating activity, raise chicken, raise cows, raise vegetables, or make baskets, and change their world by income generation. And the bank itself is owned by the borrowers. Now we have 7.5 million borrowers in Grameen Bank. 97% of them are women. We lend out over $100 million a month to those people, with an average loan about $200, and the repayment rate is very high.
Still
98%, 99%. It never faltered from that.
Can you measure economically the impact of Grameen Bank on this country, Bangladesh?
Bangladesh has moved into a pretty decent growth rate in the recent years. Besides the growth rate, what is more important is the impact on the very bottom people. Sometimes you have a very high growth in an economy, but that economy is growing at the top, but no impact on the bottom people. But in Bangladesh, it's the bottom people who are bringing dynamism into the economy. So you see, it's a kind of dramatic change of Bangladeshi society in the last 25 years. You go anywhere in Bangladesh, extreme poverty is gone. People are making a life of their own, and they can feed themselves throughout the year. The hunger is not common in Bangladesh.
Now, your critics say you hook people on loans, don't they?
Well, the critics have been saying lots of different things. I mean, you can say they are hooked. At the same time, you say, well, you have reached them for financial services. So if financial service is something they need, they keep coming back so that they can change their world, change their life, change their children's life.
That's what Muhammad Yunus thinks as founder of what is now a much-imitated international micro-lending movement. But what about the borrowers? Grameen means village, so I've come to a village 25 miles from Dhaka to hear these women in a chant of appreciation. Unity, work, discipline, this is how we develop our life. Long live Grameen Bank. Some of the group tell me how they built growing businesses using a succession of Grameen loans. Hello. How much have you borrowed and for what?
My name is Firoza Begum. I first borrowed 3,000 taka.
That's £30, $45, yes.
My financial situation was very bad. I have three children and I couldn't feed them or clothe them properly or send them to school. I was very, very poor. Then I heard that Grameen Bank was coming. So I became a member and first I borrowed 3,000 taka and I bought a cow. And then I used to sell the milk and pay back my loan in installments.
How long ago was that?
23 years ago.
That's when Grameen Bank came here. You've been getting loans ever since. Bigger and bigger ones?
Yes. I borrowed more money and bought 15 rickshaws.
15, all with Grameen Bank loans?
Yes. After I bought the 15 rickshaws, the Grameen Bank officials said that you are earning enough, so why don't you buy an auto rickshaw?
So you've got the cows, you've got 15 rickshaws, you've got the auto rickshaw. How did that go?
I sold all the rickshaws and the auto rickshaw and I opened a shop and bought some land. The land is now worth 10 million taka or 100,000 pounds.
And it's all from one loan?
Yes, it all started with the first loan of 3,000 taka.
So everybody here rich now?
Yes, they're all better off.
Well, microlending certainly seems to work here in just one village. But on the world scale, there are now doubts about it and skepticism.
My name is Dean Carlin, professor of economics at Yale University.
Professor Carlin thinks the dramatic claims for the microlending marvel have been overstated.
One thing that we're learning clearly is that microcredit is not a panacea, that it will transform the lives of the poor. It's not to say that it's bad. It's not to say that it's even neutral. There are pockets where it is effective. There are pockets where it's not. The challenge here is learning what pockets are which, how to encourage banks to do the work that helps people improve their lives, and how to address the people who are not made better off by credit and figure out what it is that they need. There's a basic paradox here in terms of the rhetoric and the popular opinion. In the United States and Europe, we often look at the explosion of consumer credit as a part of the cause of the financial crisis, overborrowing. But yet in developing countries, we think that the answer, or some people argue that the answer is take on more credit. And, you know, this is not an easy two opinions to reconcile. And the right answer probably is that credit can be good, but it also can be bad. And figuring out when it is which is a very helpful thing to know.
The micro lenders say they are lending one by one to people, building up a credit reputation on repaying a short-term loan and then getting a larger one, doing things with it so you get more chickens or whatever the development process is. Nothing like that rush to lend, packaging up the toxic loans that poor people took up to buy houses in the United States that caused such difficulty. Quite a different approach. A return to ancient principles of banking, if you like. That's what the microlenders claim they're doing, or some of them.
They do, but I'm not sure what the real difference is at a very basic level. I mean, you still have some important principles about affordability of credit, about what is the return that someone is going to be doing with the loan that can justify the borrowing. And in a lot of cases, it's not so hard to imagine a story where there is huge returns, where someone can borrow at a high interest rate and make even more money. But then there's a lot of situations where that may not be the case. And a lot of the microcredit movement is based on this idea of entrepreneurial credit, but yet a lot of the money is actually used for consumption.
That's the not so pleasant secret, isn't it? That this is supposed to be an entrepreneurial thing, but in fact some of it goes straight into consumption, you say?
Yes and no. That is definitely the kind of the secret that no one seems to want to talk about. Having said that, that itself is not a problem. There's nothing wrong with giving someone access to credit if it allows them to smooth a shock. Someone dies in their family. Someone is sick. Being able to use the money for consumption is not necessarily bad, but yet it is not as sexy for the rhetoric. That is true.
What is there from a Yale professor that microloans for entrepreneurs are being diverted into loans to buy consumer goods? and they don't provide an automatic way of repaying the loan. This may undermine the potent micro-lending reputation. Back here in Bangladesh, they've been experiencing what micro-lending actually does at first hand for decades. One close observer is Syed Hashimi, director of the BRAC Development Institute. I'll tell you about BRAC later.
What we try to say is, yes, there is a lot of entrepreneurship, but that's not the only thing that's happening. And yes, microfinance does play a positive role, but one should guard against the negative, guard against increasing indebtedness, guard against bubbles. So there has to be a lot more conscious effort at making sure you're not just lending out to everyone, that it's risky, and you have to protect against that.
And the conservatism that seems so admirable in the way you build a credit record by paying your money back fast and then coming back for another bigger loan and so on and so on, this building a reputation, building a credit record, that kind of gets eroded, maybe not in Bangladesh, but over in India, when an awful lot of lenders wade into the marketplace and start handing out loans willy-nilly in slums without the kind of reputational guarantees, the trust that original micro-lending seems to have had.
Yeah, I think you've raised an extremely important point, and we see this in what's happening in Pakistan right now. And let me try to make a distinction. In Bangladesh, what the microfinance institutions have done is built client loyalty, is built a relationship with the client, so there is a strong staff-client interface. And so therefore, when loans are made, they recognize the limits to the absorptive capacity of that household. So they're far more cautious. And also, clients themselves feel much more responsible with the money, and so they do pay back. So
that's in Bangladesh.
In Pakistan now, the push to become financially sustainable as a driving force has led many institutions. I'm thinking, and I won't mention names, the most important one in Pakistan, it drove them to overlend, to cut down on costs.
You don't know your clients so well.
Precisely. They have one staff taking care of too many loans, so that relationship broke down. And you have a classic situation now where they're not paying back. And in Pakistan, whereas, 2 to 5% portfolio at risk, bad loans are acceptable, in Pakistan you have a situation where it's up to 60-80%.
For some more insights into how this actually works, listen to Stuart Rutherford. He's a long-time British aid worker in Bangladesh who actually started his own small-scale microfinance operation here called SafeSave 13 years ago.
One of the really big differences between what we do and what the traditional microfinance organisations do is that we are trying to be the partner of choice for poor people when they try to simply manage their money. This doesn't mean that every loan taken has to be used in a business. We're perfectly happy if people use their loans to deal with health problems, to deal with other kinds of emergencies, to invest in education, to buy a sack of rice, to keep eating, because we recognize that if you're poor, you have severe money management problems. We do savings as well as loans, so people get the daily opportunity either to save or to repay on a loan. Why daily? Because incomes are very small, and not only are they small, but they tend to be unreliable and irregular. And therefore, unless you have a frequent opportunity to set aside a sum of money, no matter how small, you won't be able to maximize the amount you save. You won't be able to maximize the speed at which you repay your loan. So we are taking sums that are very, very small. In some cases, we take sums as small as 2 local taka, which is about 3 pence.
Well, we ought to go and see how it actually goes on from the collector's point of view, yes, because this is a very important part of what you do here.
Certainly, and we have a collector right with us now, and we can follow her into the slum and we can watch her at work.
Okay. This is a slum in Dakar called the Geneva Camp. It's named after the United Nations Convention on Refugees. These are Biharis, supporters of Pakistan, 25,000 of them, many stranded here when Bangladesh split from Pakistan 37 years ago. Now we're going down a narrow lane. And here's a curtain into a house. This is you checking now. This is the passbook.
Yes, it's a passbook.
Client's passbook.
Your name is Dani.
Lots of entries here, and you've got the computer printout as well. And then you're putting, what are you paying in today?
10 taka. Paying 10 taka.
10 taka, that's, just under 10 pence in English money. Then in it goes with the number. That's into the palm, the computer that carries all the records for this collector. Is this just savings or also borrowing?
Savings? I think savings.
Do you have some idea what you'll spend the money on?
Idhar kapon ne, aur onno kaje, cosmetic saman ne.
She would like to use her savings, deposited savings for buying clothing during Eid festival.
How often do you pay into the account? How often do you say?
Almost
every day. Every day.
A little bit of money every day, and it builds up, does it?
Yes.
And the collector goes from one house to the other, taking in tiny amounts of savings or not giving out big sums because then you have to go to the branch. I mean, people criticise this, don't they, Stuart? People say, oh, this is not proper micro-lending, this is lending for consumer finance.
Just because micro-lending for micro-enterprise development has been so successful, that doesn't mean to say it's the only money management service you want. There are many, many other things you need to manage your money for, and we intend to serve all those needs.
I've bumped through the horrid, horrid roads, hooting for 2 hours out of Dakar to the countryside. It's rather beautiful here. Lovely hot day, of course. The rice just getting ready for harvesting. And I've come to a village called, where are we?
Djoulapa.
Djoulapa. Come to a village which is full of activity, lots of fields, lots of farming. And here's a group of women, and they're all here because they're borrowers from an NGO called Ghana Union Foundation. And they've all come here to pay their money and to, have a bit of a chat, I think. You're in the middle. What's your name?
My name is Nur Jahan.
How much have you borrowed?
30,000 taka.
30,000. That's quite a lot of money. What are you using the money for?
Doing business.
What sort of business?
Dorji.
Tailoring.
Tailoring business. So you have a sewing machine, do you?
Oh, I'm the shirt.
She says your shirt is made by him.
Well, actually, I've got holes here. You could do something about it. So you borrow 30,000 taka, which is £300, quite a lot of money. How long do you have the loan for?
5 years.
5 years. So you're paying it tiny bits back. How much are you paying back every week?
750 taka per week.
That's £7.50 or $10. That's quite a lot of money to pay back. Do people have many loans?
Yes, many people says many loans.
Lots of money borrowed from many lenders.
Many people take loans from many lenders, but she's only one.
What difference has this big loan made to you?
She says these loans are helpful for her financial capacity build-up and her lifestyle has improved a lot from the previous years.
What does your husband do?
Her husband does the same job.
Oh, I see. So it's a family business.
Family business.
Yeah. What are other people here borrowing money for?
She has a business of bamboo business.
How much have you borrowed?
30,000.
30,000
taka. She bought cows.
How much borrowed?
20,000.
I'm cow kinchi.
Cows, more cows. How easy is it to repay the money and all these things?
They said they are happy with the loan and it will not too much time to repay the loans.
And then will you get another loan?
Yes.
To buy more bamboo.
Yes.
She says she likes to buy more bamboo.
It is experiences like this that have made micro-lending a fashionable thing to get involved with, and that's where the doubts start to grow. The on-the-ground micro-lending organisations, with their conservative rules and their know-your-customer strictness, have attracted Western financiers who want to lend money to a rewarding enterprise with a superb repayment rate and the kudos of helping the poor. But look what happened when international bankers got involved in helping American poor people buy their homes, the subprime crisis followed by a disastrous credit crunch. Could micro-lending turn into a bubble too? In Switzerland, Jacques Gravel is founder and chairman of FinEthic, an organisation trying to persuade pension funds to invest in microfinance operations. Isn't he worried that Western investors will produce a micro-lending bubble?
If we go too fast and we put too much money into the system because we find exactly what you said, a magic system, or we can deliver a terrific return, I mean, we will push naturally the people to offer loans to consumer. And of course, when you provide consumer loans, which does not bring any return to the people who get the loan, I mean, of course, you are not going to help the poor people. And this is a risk. It is what happened actually in India. It's not the case everywhere. And that's why it's so important to have a good due diligence on microfinance institution. And when I mentioned that we have to also to keep a little bit the investment bankers at the gate, if you go too fast, of course, you're going to break the machine. And now, luckily, finally, the crisis that we had in 2008-2009 as a little bit slow down the investments in microfinance. But if we had keep the pace and the speed and the enthusiasm that we had in 2006 and 2007, definitely I think we were too fast and too much money actually were in the system. And it's a risk. It's definitely a risk, yeah.
One of the most vocal critics in Bangladesh is M.M. Akash, professor of economics at the University of Dhaka.
I think the rich world should know their own history and learn from that history. Nowhere in the world poverty has been eradicated through microcredit. Everywhere it has been eradicated through industrial revolution and agrarian revolution. A large-scale rise of productive forces. Tiny capital can at best act as a safety net. When you are going to be drowned, that safety net keeps you alive so that you can become a source of cheap labor in future in actual industrialization and agrarian revolution.
In Bangladesh, there's been quite bitter criticism of the high market-based interest rates charged by the micro-lenders. Listen to the country's finance minister, AMA Muhit.
There's the allegation in this country that microfinance is very expensive. The interest rate may be low, but other things, charges, insurance fees and so on and so forth, they are pretty high.
And there have been loud criticisms of that here.
In the case of Grameen Bank, let us say, it goes to almost 22-24%, you see. There also, I said, look, at least they have brought down the usurious rates which used to prevail in the informal market. It used to be 100% or even more than that. So they have at least brought it down to less than 30%. Now, with business growing, they should be bringing it down further. You see, when Grameen Bank came into existence, we had the calculation at that time that it takes 6 years for any branch to have sufficient number of borrowers to become viable. Now, I'm told it takes only about 6 months to a year. What it means is that your seed money requirement is much less. And right now, there is a committee which is looking into reducing the cost of borrowing to the borrowers of microfinance, and that is being taken care of by the various microfinance institutions.
Now, in Bangladesh, there's a multitude of micro-lenders, among them one that is bigger even than Grameen, called BRAC. The initials don't stand for anything these days. In fact, BRAC is the biggest non-government organisation, NGO, in the world. It has 8.5 million borrowing members, almost all of them women. BRAC was founded by Fazli Hassan Abed just after the creation of Bangladesh in 1972 to help with the influx of Bengali refugees. But it now provides schools, healthcare, libraries, even a university. I asked Fazli Hassan Abed if the marketplace wasn't getting crowded with so many microcredit lenders.
It is a problem right now. There are too many lending agencies in Bangladesh, and you'll find that same person is borrowing probably from three organizations and getting themselves into over-borrowing.
So this wonderfully virtuous thing becomes a curse, doesn't it?
So it could become problematic. I mean, the kind of problems you have faced, for example, in your societies with credit cards. So people buy in credit more than they can afford to pay and then get into problems. So this can happen in Bangladesh too. So we are now trying to work on among ourselves to try and see that nobody borrows beyond their capacity for repayment so that they do not become indebted forever. So we are now looking at the option of creating credit bureaus where we would know exactly who has borrowed how much and so on. The same thing happened in the United States of America when they started lending money to investing without knowing customers. So
The subprime loans bubble
and things like that. This can happen in any society, in anything.
Yeah, but here it would be destructive if something like the burst of the subprime loan bubble happened, and there is now Western investment money from funds and things going into micro-lending, not so much in Bangladesh, but in some parts of the world. Is that stoking a bubble of microfinance?
Not yet. What I worry about more about Western money getting into microfinance is that there seems to be an idea that microfinance is hugely profitable. So therefore, invest in microfinance. Microfinance should not be looked on as the highly profitable enterprise. It should be looked on as a tool for poverty alleviation. Therefore, keep the interest rate as low as possible for the poor so that they can improve their livelihood and their income. That is how it should be looked at.
Fazli Hassan Abed, founder of BRAC. And there's not much room for doubt about the impact of microlending when you listen to a borrower. This is Mukili Akhtar in a village called Bogra.
I borrowed 100,000 taka.
You're a businesswoman. What do you do with the money?
I have my own house and I'm building one more story over the ground floor. I get 8,000 taka altogether from five families of garment workers who rent rooms.
Five families. And it's a good business, is it?
Yes, it's a good business. I plan to build a total of five stories.
Is that 25 families then?
Yes, 25 families could be accommodated.
You're becoming a landlord, aren't you?
Yes, inshallah, why not? Doesn't everyone want to be a rich landlord?
From the villages of Bangladesh, a clear message. Whatever the doubts of the experts, microlending is still a potent force for change.
Peter Day, the producer of In Business, was Caroline Bailey. If you've missed past editions of In Business, there's a permanent archive of most of the programmes going back over the past 6 years. You can access these via the link on our webpage on the right-hand side, called Previous Programmes. To get to the In Business page, visit the BBC Radio 4 website and follow the links. This has been a podcast from the BBC. For more information and for our terms and conditions, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4.